The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast, joining you once again on a Monday where after a series salvaging win Sunday, not all is lost for the Milwaukee Brewers. They went 2-3 over the past week. Seemed like felt worse than that, but it was just a 2-3 week. Games against the Cubs and the Cardinals, split at Wrigley, and then lost 2-3 in St. Louis. Definitely a continuing downward trend for the Milwaukee Brewers, but as they wake up Monday, they are still tied for a spot in the wild card conversation. They are tied basically with two other teams, the Phillies and the Rockies, for that last wild card. Three teams tied for two spots, with the Cardinals a half game back, the Dodgers hovering right there. I mean, basically, it's super tight. There's a ton of teams in this conversation, and it's going to be a wild final 6 weeks. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. I'm host of the Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. We're going to do something a little bit different today. Rather than dwell too much on the current team, which I know people have struggled a little bit watching the Brewers in recent weeks. They've definitely been headed in a downward spiral to some degree. We're going to go back in time to the year 2008, 10 years ago, and have a conversation with the one and only CC Sabathia. I went to the south side of Chicago to chat with Sabathia, who is now continuing a great career with the New York Yankees. He continues to be very effective. 10 years after he led the Brewers into the playoffs for the first time in 26 years, crazy 2008 season. Absolutely nobody forgets it. And wanted to chat with him about the moment in time, that 3.5 month stretch where he was the best pitcher in baseball, pretty much. I mean, he was 11-2 for the Brewers, an ERA under 2, one of the best performances in Brewers history, got them into the playoffs. So wanted to chat with him. And before we did that, I also checked in with one of my colleagues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Kurt Hoag, who is a big fan of the Brewers' history a little bit. He's quite a bit younger than me, so there's maybe not his history maybe doesn't go back to like the 80s or late 90s or anything, but he's definitely offered some insight into the 2008 season, including where Sabathia's performance ranks in terms of greatest Brewers pitching, single season pitching performances. Is it the best performance in Brewers history? What are some things maybe we forgot about just how valuable CC Sabathia was? And kind of an interesting conversation about whether or not the Brewers would make that trade again today, knowing that they've been to the playoffs a couple times in the past decade. Would they go after that rental, that top flight rental? And I guess what many people consider mortgaging the farm, give up a ton of top prospects on the farm to bring that guy in. So we chatted about that a little bit, and I thought it was a really fun conversation. So we won't be joined this week by Tom Hodricourt and Todd Rosiak, beat reporters for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Brewers, as I mentioned, 2-3 over the past week, heading now into a homestand, starting with the Cincinnati Reds and the Pittsburgh Pirates. Quickly, it's definitely been a rough stretch, and I'm struggling with a lot of the things that I think a lot of fans are, like the emphasis really on Friday night's game was why Craig Counsell elected not to go to one of his top relievers, namely Jeremy Jeffress or Josh Hader, when the Brewers had scored a couple times to get within a run of the Cardinals going into the ninth inning, into the bottom of the eighth. Jordan Lyles, who had pitched the seventh, came back for the eighth and ultimately gave up a couple runs that put the game out of reach. I mean, I'm right there with everybody. I didn't understand the decision at the time. I've heard Craig Counsell and others talk about it. I still don't really understand it. I feel like if you're going to want to save sort of an ace in the hole and out of your bullpen for the stretch run, this is the stretch run. It is August 19th, and honestly, there's just not a lot of baseball left, so you're going to want to bring out the big guns for those big moments. You can just as easily say the Brewers didn't score another run, so they might have lost anyway. They would have wasted that bullet, but Hader hadn't pitched in 6 days at that point, and it seemed like the right spot for him. I still don't really understand that, but that said, when we're talking about bullpen stuff, that's the thing that everybody really complains about the most with managers, but we never have the full picture. We never know exactly what's going on behind the scenes, stuff that isn't going to be put out there, and that could have stuff to do with health, that could have stuff to do with just matchup stuff that the manager doesn't want to reveal in case it comes up again. It could be any number of things. So ultimately, I'm as confused as a lot of people, but there's still so much there, and always, you know, I'm still willing to give Craig Counsell the benefit of the doubt really, really impressed with the way he managed the bullpen throughout most of the season. I definitely have my quibbles, like I'm sure a lot of fans do, about how things have played out since Corey Knebel specifically came back from his injury, when he was placed as sort of the closer, no matter what, in situations where it seemed like maybe another arm would be called for. But still, I always pause and think twice before opining about bullpen usage, because you just never know what's going on. I certainly don't have any inside info. There may be nothing going on. It might be completely face value, but there's always a little bit something going on when you're talking about bullpen usage. So with that, three quick things. I'm trying to find optimism, because the Brewers have had such a bad month on the mound. Easily the worst pitching team in the NL in the month of August. A full run of ERA worse than the next worst team. I mean, it's bad. But I'm trying to find some reasons for optimism. So here's three quick things that I found before we get into talking about the 2008 season. First of all, their schedule is comfortable. I don't know if you'd call it an easy schedule, but they play the Reds 12 times. They've got 9 games left against the Pirates. Those are both teams that, I mean, the Pirates are a 500 team and have proven dangerous, but those are teams that you've got to feel like the Brewers have a pretty good chance holding their own against, especially with a fair amount of home games left, including in September, a lot of home games on the docket. They close the season at home against the Detroit Tigers, one of the weakest teams in baseball, and that should be, I mean, you can never really tell how a team is going to do no matter what the record of the opponent is. I think this season has given us some examples of that, but you still have to like where they sit in that case. They go to Washington to face a Nationals team that's dangerous, but is drifting further and further from the playoff conversation. A lot of intra-division games. 3 more against the Cardinals. That's going to decide the season series, probably. Well, no, definitely. Those two teams are tied 8-8 in the season series thus far. So those are going to be 3 big games before that Tiger series to close down the season, and some opportunities to keep winning, especially with the Reds. The Reds are bad. They're very bad. They come into Milwaukee with Joey Votto on the disabled list, so that's definitely something to take comfort in. Second of all, this isn't really something that directly relates to the 2018 Brewers, but I know a lot of fans feel like this is the same thing that keeps happening over and over. 2014, the Brewers were in contention and then faded. Last year, the Brewers were in contention early. Here we are again, a Brewers team that was very much in control of their playoff destiny for a while, and now find themselves in a dogfight with several other teams. If you want to take comfort, first of all, let's talk about that 2008 season. They were 2.5 games out with 8 days left in the season. You could say this was improbable. It required a lot of wins late in the season. It required the Mets to really tail off at the end, of course. Not only did they make up those 2.5 games, they made up another game and got into the playoffs by a full game over the Mets. So that was a 3.5 game makeup in 8 days. It just goes to show that that is completely possible, and being tied or half game out with 6 weeks to go is nothing to be concerned about in the grand scheme of things. I mean, you could feel concerned that the team is struggling and drifting downward and doesn't seem to have a winning streak in them, if that's how you feel. But, there are so many historical examples where this is something that they could dig themselves out of. I looked back at 2017 and I forgot how far they had fallen. I mean, they, as of on August 19th, through Sunday, at this point in 2017, they were only 4 games above 500. They were 3.5 out from the wild card. It was a different year. There weren't as many contenders in the National League. A lot of teams had fallen off. There weren't as many teams that were just good last year. But they were 3.5 games out. They had been 6.5 out just on August 11th when they were at 500. They were a 500 team August 11th. And, of course, they head into the week 12 games over 500. Very different situation this year. So there's, you got to feel good about that, because we remember in 2017 they finished 1 game out of a playoff spot and went into the second to the last day of the season still alive for a spot, and actually lost a really tough game against the Cardinals that put them out of contention there. But still, there's so much time left. I know it doesn't feel like, and I know it feels like they're drifting out of the picture, but they could just as easily turn on a dime here. We have seen examples of that throughout the course of history. So if you want to look at the historical standpoint, that's fine. The other thing, third thing, the offense is actually not that bad. I know there's been a little concern that it hasn't been as good as you'd like after they added a couple pieces at the deadline. Even in this last series where they just scored 2 runs apiece in 3 games against the Cardinals, they did they do average 4.5 runs a game in August. They're one of the top 5 or 6 offenses in the National League as it relates to OPS. In fact, I think they're top 5 in OPS, which tells me that even though they haven't scored a ton of runs, that they're still 7th or so in the National League in runs scored. They just as easily could turn around tomorrow and score 10. It's really, they've had some bad luck. They've had some situations where they haven't come through in the clutch, which your mileage may vary on how much you feel about clutch. I definitely don't think it's a thing, but you may, I don't know. But this team is still a good offensive team, and they're going to be fine. They've improved from the last couple months offensively. The additions at the deadline seem to have helped. Obviously, Mike Moustakas had a huge hit Sunday and has found himself Johnny on the spot a couple times. They're going to be fine that way. The pitching is a question mark. I totally would be worried about that. Guys who haven't been effective, starters, relievers. But they also, you know, they were also fine in August, and or I should say in July and June. They were fine. So there is some hope that this is just an aberration and they can turn it around a little bit. It does sometimes feel like Ulys Chacin is the only reliable starter and that they only have one or two arms out of the bullpen that you really trust. At least that's the case right now. But that one might require a little bit of belief that they're going to be able to turn it around. It's still a possibility. Again, we've seen a lot of those cases over the course of time. Sunday's game, they are pretty lucky. They did get away with one, I think. There was a drive at the end against Josh Hader that almost left the yard. Matt Carpenter hit a ball that almost left the yard. Either run would have been clutch. Moustakas' 2-run double just barely inside the line. It was a game of inches all the way around, but they did come away with a win. They do hold off St. Louis there. And they could wind up again, like I said, winning the season series, which could be big in tiebreaker situations. With a lot of these teams that the Brewers are competing for in tiebreaker situations, they do have some favorable numbers against them if we're looking at head-to-head, which is what will determine home field advantage. They're 5-1 against Arizona, a team that I think could fall into this wild card mix or fall all the way out of it. I don't know how good of a team Arizona is at this point. They have the season series against Atlanta 4-3. They have the season series against Colorado 5-2. Philadelphia, they're tied at 3-3. I don't think they're going to wind up with the second tiebreaker, which is intra-division record, but there's a lot of intra-division games to play, so it's impossible to say at this point. They would not have the advantage against the Dodgers, and that actually would be my prediction. The Dodgers are not far out of this race. I think they're much better than their record shows, and I do think that the Dodgers are still extremely scary. Once they get Kenley Jansen back, that's going to be a really good team again, and I think that's a team. That's my prediction, that the Brewers make the wild card game and face the Los Angeles Dodgers, even though that's not one of the teams at the very top of this crazy clustered leaderboard for the wild card spot. All right, so enough about the 2018 team. We will check in again with Todd and Tom next week. But now let's go. Let's talk to Kurt Hoge. We'll go back in time a little bit to 2008. Discuss some of the things you may have forgotten about Sabathia's wild ride or about that season in general. And then after that, I've got my interview with the one and only CC Sabathia. Give a listen to this. And now I'm joined by a very special guest. This is Kurt Hoge. He is actually my successor covering prep sports at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but he's also kind of the self-appointed expert on the 2008 Milwaukee Brewers season. Is that fair? Can I call you the expert on 2008 Brewers?
I wouldn't say self-appointed. I would say you disappointed me that, but
I
sure.
Did we'll point you that. That's
for
correct.
This
That's
podcast,
correct.
We'll say yes.
All right, perfect. So you know a lot about the 2008 Brewers. I feel like I know a fair amount, too. I was there for the whole ride, and actually, if you want to catch my month-by-month recaps of the 2008 season, the 10th anniversary of the 2008 season, including, of course, the acquisition of CC Sabathia. He'll be our subject here in a minute. You can find all that at jsonline.com. The month of August was an interesting one for Sabathia because, A, he was amazing, just like he was in July. And also on August 31st, he threw a one-hitter against the Pittsburgh Pirates, which some would argue,
some,
all Brewers fans for the most part would argue, was a no-hitter. The slow roller back to the pitcher's mound that he could not handle was ruled a hit immediately. It was the only hit he gave up all day. It would have been his own error, but it's still, you know,
yes,
by letter of the law, a no-hitter. Let's start there. How do you feel about that game? Because I know, I mean, obviously you feel how I do. You feel it should have been an error. But, like, do you really feel that way? Or?
A few things stand out in my mind. Yes, first off, I feel that's an error. That's a play pitcher should make at least 75-80% of the time. You just pick up the ball with your bare hand, you throw it first. That's an out. I believe that was Andy LaRoche that hit the ball.
Seems right to me, sure.
We'll go with that. What stands out in my mind, though, is I remember after the game, towards the end in that ninth inning, the Pirates fans were cheering for him.
For Sabathia.
For Sabathia to, to finish up the game. And they knew that it was supposedly a no-hitter. And also, I mean, not only do you and I think that it was a no-hitter, Ned Yost also thought it was a no-hitter.
Oh, my gosh. Ned Yost lost his mind after
that. They challenged the ruling, and then they lost. And Juan Yavis's place in history is secure. So is Bill Schroeder's.
Juan Yavis and Bill Schroeder. their collective place in history is secure. Yeah, I know that the official score took a lot of heat from Milwaukee fans, Milwaukee players. At the time they protested it, after the game they protested it, they did appeal to the league office. But if I recall, the league office only overturns it in just the rarest of cases, misinterpretation of the rule or whatever. And the official score said point blank, if it had been normal effort, he would have... It required more than normal effort to make that play, and therefore it's a hit. If it had been just a routine or something or other, then it would have been an error. I still feel like it's a play that anybody would have made. I'm sure CeCe Sabathia thought he could have made it. I'm sure most people think he could have made it. But, you know, I guess it softens the blow a little bit that it was his own error. So it's not like we're talking about somebody else in the mix.
Yeah, it's plays like that really makes me not envy the official scorer either.
Right. It's a tough job. It's a bad job, actually.
It is actually bad.
It is actually a bad job. So the famous, probably the most famous one-hitter in Brewers history capped off the month of August. We won't talk about the month of September because for the most part, for the first half of the month, that was very bad. But then, of course, Sabathia helps get this team in the playoffs pretty much single-handedly with a tremendous performance down the stretch. So let's talk a little bit about the historical context of what Sabathia meant to the Brewers. I think we can all agree that without that acquisition in early July, they don't go to the playoffs. It's almost inconceivable to imagine them getting to the playoffs without Sabathia. The question is, where do we rank that in terms of great performances in Brewers pitching history? Is that the greatest season a Brewers pitcher has had? I mean, it's obviously truncated is the wrong word, but it's shorter than a full season, so it probably isn't. But, oh, man, you got to think about it when you embrace the... You know, the getting to the playoffs for the first time in 26 years. It was so incredible.
Right. And the historical context makes it maybe the most special Brewers pitching season ever. I think if we're looking at the best Brewers pitching season ever, we got to go. I have to go with 2004 Ben Sheets.
Yes.
I'm not sure what's more. I mean, we do not like pitcher wins in this podcast recording session, right?
We don't.
Now. We do not like them. However, Ben Sheets won 12 games on the 2004 Milwaukee Brewers, which is almost as impressive as his actual numbers, 2.70 ERA, 2.65 FIP. He struck out over 10 batters per nine innings, walked 1.22 per nine innings. He was just flat out incredible that year. Fangraphs has him at 8 wins above replacement, which is
Holy
the best
smokes.
Season by any Brewers pitcher ever by 1.3 wins above your boy, Teddy Higuera.
Yes. Yes, perhaps the best lefty in Brewers history if you count players who pitched at least a full season.
Don't slander Chris Narvison in such a way.
Oh, dude, I totally forgot Chris Narvison was in that game, the game 6 of the NLCS that year in 2011.
We don't talk about that.
I know we don't. But anyway, so Ben Sheets, what he did was insane. Now, that's the year, correct me if I'm wrong, 18 strikeouts against the Atlanta Braves, right?
Yes.
In the early part of the year, May of that year, which was a feat that will pretty much live in infamy regardless of how you remember his whole season. Yeah, he didn't get the wins because wins are a dumb stat, but he definitely, that is the best season in Brewers history. And even when you look at Sabathia, I think you got to go with 2004 Ben Sheets. It hurts to kind of say that.
Incredible. But. Like, maybe the most underappreciated season in the last 20 years of pitching. He's incredible.
So do you put Sabathia at number 2 or do you think he's further down the list?
I think if I'm being honest, in the scope of an entire season, there were guys that had a better accumulation of numbers in terms, if you're like WAR is a counting stat. So, but I don't know how you could put, say, 89 Chris Bosio above 2008 CeCe Sabathia.
Ooh, and we don't like Chris Bosio. We don't talk about Chris Bosio here.
No, this is an anti-Chris Bosio.
We're done with Chris Bosio.
Yes.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a little bit apples to oranges. Higuera was really well respected in his time, and that's a little bit before my time. I vaguely remember seeing him pitch. And I'm in my sort of late 30s here, so
you're dating yourself.
I am dating myself. So it's kind of to the point, I think a little bit that Higuera is also a little bit underrated in his history too, because he isn't a guy that you see around the park a lot. He's not a guy who's, you know, he's not, his number isn't retired. Probably, I guess you could make an argument it could be. I mean, he had some of the best seasons. I think he's got three of the top eight if you look at Fangraphs. The
probably the best pitcher in franchise history.
He is the best pitcher in franchise history, which is I think quite the accomplishment.
Yeah, so now I'm mad. I'm mad online about the 2008 Cy Young voting.
Okay.
Ben Sheets was eighth, so he was the last one to receive votes.
This is 2008 or 2004?
2004, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, correct. Okay.
That was correct. So he was the last one. He had tied for eighth. Nine people received votes, so he was tied with Brad Lidge, who had a very good season, but he was a closer.
Is that the year that Brad Lidge was perfect?
No, that was I think that was 08.
I think it was, too, when they
Brewers
won the World Series.
Got to him, though, in the playoffs a couple times.
Cy.
Randy Johnson actually didn't even win. And he was even more amazing than Roger Clemens, who won. But Ben Sheets Ben Sheets probably should have won that thing, but he didn't have very many wins.
This definitely predates the voters mentality that wins don't matter as much, and yep. That we can look at some of these peripheral stats, because peripherally speaking, that was a pretty dominant season. Hard to argue against Roger Clemens. Retrospectively, maybe you do, but he also had a very good season.
A sub-1 whip for Ben Sheets. So this has turned into
Sheets
appreciation podcast.
Well, we've talked about this. Ben Sheets is my guy. He is my favorite brewer in brewer history, so I am happy to talk about him all day long. But unfortunately, because Ben Sheets was injured at the end of the season, he doesn't get nearly the credit he deserves for that 2008 run. The idea with Sabathia was really to kind of couple him with Ben Sheets as sort of a 1-2 punch. Wasn't sure what Sheets' future was going to be after that season, so it was definitely a win now or go home. And Doug Melvin makes the move July 6th, I believe, is the day that they acquire Sabathia. He's on the mound July 8th against the Rockies, and the rest kind of becomes history there. There is a little bit of sentiment. This is going to sound like a stupid question. What is it a trade that you would do again today? And here's where I'm coming from with that. If you know that the team isn't going to advance in the playoffs or isn't going to win the World Series, do you still make the move to get a guy that is, in air quotes here, hurting your farm system and giving up what we now know, Michael Brantley, a 10-year veteran, multi-time All-Star? Do you make the deal again? I think I know the answer, and I think it's pretty simple, but give me some context.
It's interesting. To kind of discuss the question a little bit, I need a little clarity on what you're asking. Are you asking that if we just took everything that was present then, and if we took the trade and put it into 2018, the current Brewers are trading for CC Sabathia in the current scheme of things? They went to the playoffs in 2008. They went again in 2011. All those things happened. I don't know if I would do the trade now.
Yeah, an interesting way to put it.
But when you think in the scope of 2008, I don't know how you wouldn't, because the ends did justify the means. They gave up Michael Brantley, and they also gave up Matt LaPorta, who was the guy at the time. He was the Keston Hiura of that time. And so if you're looking at that trade in 2018, it's like, oh, the Brewers are giving up what? Maybe Keston Hiura, maybe a Caden Lemons and a Mauricio Dubon. That's a lot for a 3-month rental.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's interesting. You're right about putting it in context to today, because it's hard to, especially now that 10 years have gone by, it's hard to really explain what it was like to be a Brewer fan prior to going back to the playoffs. Because in 2006, 2007 was a really tough year. They started out hot. I believe that's the year they started out famously 24-10 and then skidded down the stretch. There was so much despair, way more than there even is now. And there's a lot of fatalism in Brewers fandom. I think that's probably true of a lot of fan bases, but definitely in Milwaukee, there's a lot of fatalism. Back then, it was so bad because the Brewers just hadn't even been a winner since until 05, when I think they went 500. Mm-hmm. And it was just assumed that they were going to screw this up. And really, 2008, they almost did. I mean, they had such a terrible September, had to really rally back. That's what I keep thinking about with this year's team. You know, there were only six games to go, and they were, you know, 2.5 games out of the last playoff spot. So it was definitely a dire straight situation there, too. It was just different. And now, yes, you want the Brewers to go back to the playoffs, but at least the Brewers fans have tasted a little bit of that, and there isn't this, like, generational void that you're feeling.
Right, and I think in sports, and this is a broader sports thing, if you're only basing success off winning championship, that's a lot less fun
fan.
Like, sports are meant to be entertainment. They're meant to be fun. And so maybe it's the Badgers winning the Orange Bowl, and, you know, or you define that as success. It's not a national championship. It's disappointing to not get that. But if you are saying everything's a failure and I'm going to be upset unless we win a championship every year. That's going to be a tough life as a sports fan. So you take that and you look at the 2008 Brewers, and all of a sudden that becomes a very, very special year, because it ended a 26-year drought, most success that you've had in almost three decades, and all those things. So yeah, of course, you do that trade a million times over in 2008.
Here's a little bit more of a pessimistic look then at the question: would you do the trade again, knowing that the Brewers are not going to be able to sustain success? They took their shot in 2008. Whatever the outcome was, they made the playoffs, but then the next couple of years they were down. And I don't think it's because of one trade, but there is a thought out there that, you know, the team shouldn't be making those risks. They shouldn't be going all in on rentals, no matter how good they are. And the example is, the famous example is Doyle Alexander getting traded in the 80s for John Smoltz, trade between the Tigers and the Braves. John Smoltz was a very young prospect at the time, obviously goes on to be a Hall of Fame pitcher. The Tigers got Alexander, who, by the way, was amazing in 87. Amazing. Absolutely comparable to what CC Sabathia did in 2008. And on top of it, he came back in 88 and had an all-star. Well, he was an all-star in the first half. His final numbers don't look great. He was at the end of his career. It was unquestionably a short-term move for a long-term one, and didn't work out. This isn't quite that level with the John Smoltz, but, you know, they did give up a player who is a MVP candidate from time to time and an absolute, you know, definitely somebody that the Brewers could have made use of, you know, Michael Brantley. I still think it's a deal, though, that you make. I would have made the Doyle Alexander and John Smoltz trade, even knowing what I know today, because you just got to take those shots, mm-hmm. especially as a small market team. You don't get a chance to sustain success. Who has been able to do that in a small market? It is unheard of that a team can actually make, you know, have successful playoff runs year over year over year as a small market team.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But what I would say to that, to quote old friend Jonathan Villar, JR.
Jonathan VR.
That's the game.
We'll miss you. That's the game.
That's the game.
Yep.
That's how it is.
Yeah, it is. So
you got to make those trades sometimes.
It's true. I would certainly make the deal 10 times out of 10, but I guess I can understand why some people might not. I wonder if there's any ripple effects to 2011. If Sabathia doesn't get traded, are they still a team that hasn't gone to the playoffs? I mean, 2011 was such an independently great year, 96 wins. They make the trade for Greinke, and that helped, but that team seemed like it was destined for the playoffs regardless of what happened. I would just be curious if there was any sort of, well, Sabathia worked out, so we're going to go get Greinke, and we're going to go get Sean Markham, and we're not going to think about prospects as much. You know, I wonder if there's any of that sort of even subconscious mentality coming into the 2011 season, which Sean Markham, I know, is a little controversial topic, but, like, he was really big in the regular season them to that point, so I'd be interested to know what the butterfly effect looks like if they don't trade for Sabathia. Tell me some things that we may not even remember about how great Sabathia was. I know you were looking up some tidbits, and there were some interesting things.
So I think we all remember, just in general, CC Sabathia was great. He pitched on short days rest a lot. He pitched late into games a lot. He didn't give up many hits or runs, all those things. This one's fun. He pitched in 17 games for the Brewers that year.
11-2, I believe his record was.
Yes. He lost those two games in September, both on they were part of his four games in 14 days stretch.
Let me tell you a story about one of those days. September 20th, 2008, the year of our Lord, the year I was married. Yes. No, the day I was married, the very day.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's 10 years. Hashtag blessed. And that night, Sabathia pitched. It was against the Reds. The Reds beat the Brewers. Yep. They had won the night before, which was a problem because I went out with friends the night before and was a little concerned I wasn't going to make it through my wedding the following day because I, you know, was frustrated with the Brewers and accepting every rum and coke that people wanted to give me. And then Saturday was a great day. It was a wedding, and I remember vividly the moment where I knew the Brewers were losing. I'd heard it from a friend. Didn't have a smartphone. Would have you could just see me, like, on the altar checking updates. And I let go. I was like, you know what? It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in 2008. I was fine. Had a great night. The Racing Sausages came to our wedding.
Incredible.
A surprise organized by some of my friends. I did not know about this. It was wonderful. And we went to Lake Geneva for the weekend, and I was not worried about the Brewers. It was a very liberating feeling. And then, like, in the course of two or three days, they got back within a half game or something of the Mets, and then, of course, they were back and forth. So, like, endured the last week of the season right back in the heart, you know, the heart-stopping moments. But I really thought it was over. I really believed it was over.
It almost was. They were 2.5 games back. Okay, this isn't a quote from this year. It's a quote from the year before, which is probably the – Except for the Carlos Gomez quote in the Sports Illustrated story about he has rich people conversations now.
Yes,
this
that's
is
great.
The second best quote in Brewers lore. When the Brewers were, I believe, two games out with three games left to play in 2007 of the division, and the Cubs, Ned Yost said, quote, "The math is still on our side." Best Brewers quote.
Was the math still on their side, Kurt?
It was not then. they were 2.5 back on the 20th with 8 days left in the season in 2008. After losing to the Reds, the math was on their side because the Mets choked. They got hot. They made it. Anyway, so back to the stat. He pitched 17 games. Seven of those were complete games.
Incredible.
Since then, this is what now? Almost 11. This is almost 10 full seasons since 2008 in the Brewers' history. They've played 1,579 games. A lot of baseball. 14 complete games.
Incredible.
That a pitcher's thrown.
That's ridiculous. In 10 freaking years.
That's half of the amount that the entire team has thrown in the 10 years after him, and he didn't even pitch a full season.
You should keep an eye out for my August retrospective, because I think I want to do a Sporkle quiz for people to see if they can name the 14 pitchers who've thrown a complete game since the Sabathia season.
Shout out Taylor Youngman.
Yeah, if you listen to our podcast, you got one answer right there. Oh, there are some surprise names on that list.
There are
some really interesting. Taylor Youngman, though, I remember that. That was like his first or second start. It was against the Dodgers. Like, oh, Youngman, he's going to work out,
right? I do not remember that. I do remember the Mike Fiers start against LA, though.
Oh.
It was like his first start or something.
Yeah, there's old friend. Interesting names. Old friend now with the Athletics. He's probably going to pitch in the playoffs this year. Poor Ned Yost. I'm so happy he won his World Series in 2015 because
I think everybody feels
like he kind of got a raw deal there, and he did end up getting his. But that is really amazing. Seven complete games in 17 outings, and I mean, that just is unheard of across baseball now, but especially the Brewers. And now the way, I don't know, are we ever going to see a player throw multiple complete games in a year again, the way that baseball's
about? I don't even know if we've had seven complete games in the National League this year.
I don't know if we have either.
Probably have.
But Scherzer's probably got like three of them.
But like my point remains.
Right. Very interesting. What else do we know about Sabathia, or that we maybe forgot about CC Sabathia?
Well, I mean, we could just run through his numbers that year. 11-2 record, 1.65 ERA. He threw 130 innings. That's incredible.
That's incredible.
He allowed 24 runs. I mean, the fact that he only lost.
He allowed
two,
24 runs. That's it.
Time. That's it, yeah. Struck out 197. Oh, no, 128 with the Brewers. 197 was his next year.
Yeah, the next year.
He was also good. And it's not like it was just like this lucky stretch. His peripherals were actually pretty much matched his numbers. He had a 2.44 FIP, so he outperformed his peripherals a little bit, but that's just because the baseball gods were on our side.
What do you remember from the last game of the season? Obviously, there's things everyone remembers. We all remember Bob Howry's first pitch fastball and where it landed when Ryan Braun was batting in the eighth.
Yes.
We remember CC Sabathia getting the double play to end the game.
Two things. The Craig Counsell walk to tie the game.
Often forgotten.
Three things. That one, tie the game, made it feel a lot better. Like, okay, this is fine. I believe it was a Prince Fielder error that let them score their one run, an unearned run off of Sabathia.
I think Aramis Ramirez was involved in
yes,
some
he
way, shape,
yes,
or form.
He was. And then the third one was just that very loud and blood-curdling scream that Bill Schroeder let out after they turned the,
yes.
I believe, 4-6-3, 6-4-3, I don't remember what
it was, 4-6-3
to
yeah,
end 4-6. The game. But I think it was the right thing to do. It matched how it was.
Yeah, so. That's a very Larry McCarron moment, I would call it, one that really felt right in the moment.
It was the dagger.
I covered that game. It was interesting being a fan of the team and also covering it, which we've talked about this a little bit, the neutrality you sort of feel as you're covering a game. Like, you really can mentally sort of separate yourself a little bit, or at least I think we can, and I imagine most people can. So I wasn't watching it with the same maybe fervor or enthusiasm I would have watched a game of that magnitude otherwise. But I do remember feeling a knot in my chest about how it was going to end and going back into the cafeteria because I just wanted a break from watching it for a while. And it was back there that I saw Dan Uggla hit a home run, mm-hmm. which was Wes Helms is the home run that gave the Marlins the lead against the Mets. Dan Uggla hit the home run that added to the lead. And then watched the final out of that game in the clubhouse. We were kind of ushered down into the clubhouse. The Brewers were celebrating and had celebrated on the field a little bit, but they'd also then gone back and they'd gone into their cafeteria kind of away from reporters to watch the end of the game together because the Mets had to lose to officially get the mm-hmm. Brewers in the playoffs. I remember the last out was a kind of a loud out to center field.
Ryan, take me to church.
Yes. Oh, Ryan Church. There's a name. I remember it was hit pretty well off the bat. I thought, I remember I said, oh my God, I thought it could be gone. You know, center field home runs are hard to, not always the easiest to tell on TV off the bat. But then the center fielder settled under it. It was, you know, fairly routine at that point. Shy the warning track. And that was it, and the celebration was launched, and the Brewers fans could finally breathe a sigh of relief that 26 years without the playoffs was finally behind them. Man, CC Sabathia, good stuff.
Very good stuff.
Thanks for joining me, Kurt.
Yeah, it was fun.
Appreciate it.
Always here to talk about, always hashtag here to talk about CC.
Hashtag here, that's right. Let's move in now to the interview with the one, the only, CC Sabathia. He chatted with me. I went to Chicago, actually, to a White Sox game to catch up with him. And the orchestral music in the background, while perfect, is not mine. It was actually Game of Thrones night at Guaranteed Rate Field, which is what we're calling it now, on the south side of Chicago, one night before the Brewers had their Game of Thrones night. So that's what you're hearing in the background, but obviously you can still hear CC Sabathia talking about his great 2008 season. Give a listen to this.
My guest is CC Sabathia. Brewers fans know him very, very well. 10 years ago, he led the crew on a historic run to their first playoff appearance in 26 years. And CC, I'm curious, you've had two really sustained periods in your career with the Indians, obviously, won a Cy Young, now with the Yankees for the past decade, won a World Series, and then there's this 3.5-month adrenaline rush in the middle with Milwaukee. I'm just curious off the top how you look at that time period. What are some of the visuals that really stick out in your head from that period of time?
I guess just, you know, when I think about that time, I think it's just my teammates, you know, and, Mike Cameron, Ricky Weeks, Prince Fielder, Billy Hall, you know, Corey Hart, you know, I had so much fun playing on that team with those guys, and, you know, it's just the one thing that sticks out in my mind, just how much fun we had.
Well, one thing I just heard, I didn't realize how close you were with David Riske, who was one of your teammates mm-hmm. then. I imagine he helped with the transition a little bit. He was already with the Brewers at the time.
Yeah, I mean, he's still one of our best friends, you know, in the world. So, yeah, I mean, just getting a chance to play with him again was really refreshing, and it's a lot of fun, and it's a good time for us.
It seems pretty well documented that you were going to be on the move somewhere. The Dodgers actually thought they had you wrapped up. At any point, how involved were you with this process? Did you think you were going to LA at any point? Do you remember those final days?
No, I wasn't involved at all. I wasn't, I was a younger player at the time, so I wasn't, you know, that really close with the front office, so I didn't have any say about where I was going or anything like that. So I just kind of stayed out of it and just kind of let them do their thing. And, you know, not until Risky called me and told me that he saw my jerseys being made up in the back, that I knew that I was going to Milwaukee.
So they were actually making your jersey before you knew that you were going to Milwaukee. Well, you'd been to Milwaukee at least in 07 when the Angels-Indians series had been moved to Miller Park. What else did you know about Milwaukee at that point? Did you have any impression of what the city would be like?
No, I had no idea. People had told me that the fans were great and that the city was going to be fun, but I had no idea. Just that one time that I played there, you know, as a home team, moving that series there.
One of the things everybody remembers that you were acquired on the 6th and pitched on the 8th. It was all very fast. How much of that was your decision? I mean, did that make it easier for you to just get out there and start pitching right away?
Yeah, no, they gave me the decision whether I wanted to pitch, because the All-Star break was coming up. So it was, you know, if I could pitch on that Tuesday and get two starts in, or I could, you know, pitch in the middle of the week and, you know, kind of just get one start and get comfortable. But, no, I mean, once I got traded, I left right away, and I wanted to be a part of the team and help right away. So, no, it was a no-brainer. I wanted to pitch as soon as possible. My time was up, and ended up pitching twice before the All-Star break.
And hitting a home run, too.
That last game, yeah.
What do you take away? What do you remember from that first start? I know Milwaukee fans won't forget it. I'm sure you won't either.
Man, you know what? Honestly, I don't remember a lot from that first start. Yeah. Not at all. The only thing I honestly really remember thinking is that I was mad at my cleats because they were black and red,
I
needed
so
blue cleats. Yeah. So, I mean, that was the only thing that I kept just remembering and thinking about. And I think I went like 5 2/3 or 6 2/3 or something like that. But the start I really remember was the next one. That's when I kind of like got settled in and made that start against Cincinnati.
Yeah, another complete game. One of your many complete games. That was a pretty good outing with the home run in there. I think that ended up being a walk-off of the night. I think Craig Council maybe
yeah.
had a sack fly.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet. That September was really tough for Brewers fans, and I mean, sure, the Brewers as well. The sort of the tension of not having been to the playoffs in 25 years, and the team had started skidding. Were you a little bit above that because you hadn't been in Milwaukee for very long? You didn't really feel that maybe the way other players or other people were?
No, I didn't. I mean, it was definitely a big thing that I hadn't been there and wasn't a part of the organization and didn't really know the drought that the team was in. So it was just for me going out and playing every day, and, you know, we got a chance to turn this thing around and make this thing better.
August 31st is the 10-year anniversary of a game that a lot of Brewers fans think about, the one-hitter against Pittsburgh. Brewers have only had one no-hitter in their history, 1987. Everyone, myself included, definitely feels like that should have been a no-hitter as well. Well, do you still think about that game? I mean, the just miss, you know, how that could have been an error?
I don't think about it, and I don't even, like, miss it because it was called a hit so early in the game that I thought that I was pitching a one-hitter. You know what I mean? So it's not the same as pitching a no-hitter. And, you know, we got in after, and Kendall was pissed. He was like, "Man, we need to get that change." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He was like, "You only gave up one hit." I had no idea, you know. So it kind of took away from it that the fact that it happened so early in the game and that they called it a hit right away, that, you know, it was kind of, you know, just a one-hitter. It is what it is.
Yeah. There's obviously the final game, which we'll talk about in a minute. Were there any other outings that you really remember from that run? Obviously, you had 11 wins, very memorable. Pretty much every outing was memorable, but was there another one that really sticks out besides those first couple and the last one? And maybe not.
No, I mean, they all kind of just run together, to be honest. Yeah, it's all kind of just like a blur.
Sure, for a lot of people, I imagine.
Yeah.
The last game of the season is probably the best Brewers memory for any fan, really, 40 or under, in the city of Milwaukee. We remember the Braun home run. We remember the double play to end the game. Was there anything else that you remember that could have tipped the scale, something we don't maybe remember as vividly, where you maybe got away with a pitch or you got a big out?
I remember feeling like I was going to be pretty good that day. Early, you know, and I think I gave up a run early in the game, and you know, just kind of felt like that was it, though. You know, I felt like I was going to put together a pretty good start, which is, you know, something that you don't really feel during the game. But I kind of had a good feeling about that one, and felt like I was going to win that game.
You guys have been to the ALCS just the year before, so playoffs weren't new to you at that point. But,
yeah.
I mean, everybody remembers your reaction in that moment. It was a crazy moment for the fans of the game.
Well, it was a big moment for me just because I didn't pitch well in the playoffs in 2007. And, you know, being able to pitch good down that stretch in Milwaukee, I think, propelled me to be able to pitch well in the playoffs here in 09. So it was kind of all a learning process for me, you know, 07 in the playoffs, not pitching well. 09 having a good stretch in Milwaukee, then not pitching well in the playoffs in that game against Philly, and then you know, coming here and kind of having it all, run kind of like be finalized.
One last thing from that last game, was there, because you batted leading off the bottom of the eighth where the Brewers take the lead, was there any thought at all that you would come out after eight strong innings?
Not on my end. You have to ask Dale, but no. Yeah.
I'm sure Dale will not say that there was any thought whatsoever. No, there was no chance.
No, not at all.
That's great. So you probably get asked a lot about pitching on 3 days rest down the stretch. Knowing what you know now, 10 years later into your career, if you were 28 again, would you do that?
1,000%.
Really? Okay.
1,000%, without hesitation, no doubt. Put in the same situation again, having that much fun, playing with that organization and being around those people. Made it easy just to go out and take the ball and want to take the ball.
Did you have anybody advising you otherwise?
Oh, yeah, my agent was pissed.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, but I mean, we butted heads on that, but I mean, it turned out good.
From what I've read, I don't know if this is true, but that the Brewers were the only team that officially offered a contract, as well as the Yankees. You know, I think everybody understands that was the better contract offer. The Yankees had the better offer, but would you have ever considered Milwaukee before you played there? And then, I mean, I'm sure having been in the city, you kind of got to experience it firsthand, probably. I don't know if it changed your perception of the city.
No, 1,000. I mean, I wouldn't have ever considered Milwaukee before I played there. But having played there, that was the place, you know, I wanted to go back there. And I wanted to catch that magic again and that feeling. But I just felt like if I would have commanded that contract in Milwaukee, that we wouldn't have been able to sign Prince, Braun, and we'd have been able to keep the same core. So it would have been a different team.
For sure. Another question you get asked a lot, and the last one is, 10 years later, you're still effective. And I don't know if we had talked to 28-year-old CC Sabathia, would he be surprised that here you are 10 years later, having, you know, evolved to the point that you're still effective? I'm guessing you'd have felt that.
He would have definitely been surprised that I'm throwing the cutter and the sinker and, you know, losing my velocity and still being able to pitch and get guys out. That's definitely surprising.
All right, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this unusual edition of the Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. Like I said, we'll be back next week with Tom or Todd to talk about the state of the 2018 team after this pretty critical homestand gets started with the Reds and Pirates visiting town. It's going to be some there's no such thing as must wins just yet, but there are definitely some games you'd like to see the Brewers have a really healthy homestand. They've had a couple 500 homestands in the recent past. You'd like to see them sort of bust out, maybe only lose one game if possible, or two games at most on a homestand like that. So again, thanks again to CC Sabathia for joining me, for Kurt Hogue, who stopped by to chat about the 2008 team. A reminder that you should definitely check us out on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, but especially on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a review or a ranking that helps us reach more people. You can also send feedback my way on Twitter at JR Radcliffe, JRRADCLIFFE. Love hearing from you. If you've got a suggestion for a guest, somebody you'd really like me to try to track down for the podcast, I'm all ears. And we'll love to keep making this better for you. So thanks again for listening. We're going to check in with you next week. Take care.